Hello, and welcome to the Movie Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be spotlighting a movie that we think you'll find interesting. In this episode, I'm joined by my sister, and we're going to have a spoiler-filled discussion on Beverly Hills Cop 2 from 1987. This is obviously the first sequel of the franchise. We've got pretty much all the main cast members from the first. I would say the notable exception, not that it was a main cast member by any stretch, but no Serge this time. No Bronson Pinchot.
Yeah, well, and no Jenny, the friend who lived in town.
Yeah, I took both of them as being part and parcel of the case.
Yeah.
But he did make mention, I think, of Jenny at one point.
Okay.
Maybe. But in the reversal this time, the friend of Axel's who got injured doesn't die, and it was the lieutenant from the first film, Ronnie Cox's character. And it all comes down to a case he was investigating that Axel, Taggart, and Billy kind of take over.
One of the nice things they did right off the bat is we're in Detroit, we're watching Axel getting ready for his day and to go undercover, and we pan by some photos of him on a fishing vacation with Billy and Taggart.
Well, and Bogani.
Bogomil?
Bogomil, yeah, sorry. I thought he was in the photos too.
Interesting. I mainly noticed the one with the two.
But establishing that they've kept in touch, they've vacationed together.
Yeah.
That it was not just a thanks. So long.
Yeah, exactly.
And I like that because it allowed for certain things, such as Bogomil's daughter knowing Axel and stuff like that. She wasn't in the first movie. And there was really no mention of their personal lives.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciated that getting kind of layered in there. And it was also interesting that one of the guys credited for the story was Eddie Murphy.
Yes.
And I'm sure it's a, hey, let's go this way with it.
Mm-hmm.
And there were certain things that were, let's repeat what we did the first time. Other times, it's a let's do a bit of a reversal. And there's standard ways to go. If you've got a film or a TV season or whatever, we're going to do another iteration. Where do you do the same moves? Where do you zig where you zagged before? And finding out how to keep the chemistry of the property, yet shake things up enough that it doesn't feel like you've just repainted and done an editing pass on the first script.
Well, I felt it was interesting that back in Detroit, Axel was working within the system, filing the paperwork to requisition the car, that kind of stuff. He gets out to Beverly Hills. He's on his own and knows it. He lacks the paperwork. He lacks the support structure. And yet he's going about things in the same basic way. He requisitions a house after a fashion.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what I found funny was one of the recurring lines was Axel saying, or somebody saying about Axel, he wasn't always a cop. He fractured a few laws in his youth.
Yes, yes.
And I thought that was fun.
They did that particularly well between him and Taggart.
Yes, yeah. Well, and Billy having kind of that Dirty Harry era aspect with the guns and all this stuff, having been in a shootout or two in the first movie without enough ammo.
Yeah, there's almost a PTSD response that Billy has had.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm curious how that's going to play out in the third and fourth films, particularly the fourth, where a lot of time will have elapsed.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you keep the characters the same? And they were all recognizably the same, but then also move them forward a little, have them grow and change as a result of the previous films.
Yeah.
And that's something that can be easier and harder to do in a movie franchise than in a television one. Because in a movie one, you filmed the first one, you've stopped, you've stepped away, you've got time to think through the writing stage of that next film.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's coming a year or two later, you usually have had some time to stop and reflect, see what worked, where you want to go, whatever. But you're doing it in roughly 2-hour installments.
Yeah.
Whereas in a TV show, the characters are changing each and every episode in microscopic amounts.
Yeah.
That where you had them at the beginning of the first season, beginning of the second, the third, the fourth, the fifth, the sixth, if you go that long, it's harder to do intentionally sometimes And a lot of it just kind of happens. Whereas I think in movies like this, it's much more intentional.
Well, in the first movie, Axel is standing up for a childhood friend.
Mm-hmm.
And there is very much a playing on the child aspects. Whereas here, he's standing up for a professional friend, an adult friend, someone who challenged him to be more responsible.
Well, and it was funny because he's undercover, Axel's undercover in Detroit, hears a radio broadcast mentioning what happened out of the LA desk and stuff. While he is sitting in a Mark's office,
mm-hmm.
he makes the call, identifies himself as a cop. What's going on?
On the Mark's landline.
Well, everybody had landlines at that
point. Well, yeah, but...
But think about how differently that scene could have played out if that's when the Mark was walking in.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
You know?
Well, or even if you're just 20 years later and the Mark's got the equivalent of a nanny cam in his office.
Yeah. Well, I think it works better if the guy's walking in because Axel could actually play off the, I'm conning that I'm a cop.
Mm.
Not, you know, the other way around or whatever.
Well, I was thinking that if you had the nanny cam aspect, then while Axel is in Beverly Hills trying to deal with stuff, the friend who steps in for him on the undercover bit could be facing the consequences that were meant for Axel.
Yeah, Paul Reiser got a bigger role this time. Not a huge
mm-hmm.
amount of screen time, but more than just kind of that opening tag sequence in Detroit.
Yeah.
So I thought that was good. And we had a similar amount of action. One of the things I felt we got a bit more of here, although it was certainly in the first film, Axel Foley is a detective.
Yes. Yes. And they did very nicely with that here. There were times when I would say the set decorators and those people went over the top to help him. I mean, the mud tire tracks.
Yeah, the mud on the guy's shoes that's caked over and... Like he brought in
half the field.
Half the field. Yeah, that was a bit much.
The mud tire tracks that stay with the car and keep leaving mud on the pavement for how many miles?
Yeah, yeah, that was a bit much. But I appreciated that the detective work he was doing was shown,
mm-hmm.
not the typical people sitting around a murder board talking it through.
Well, and that the character was doing it in a responsible manner in terms of not accidentally stepping into the tire tracks he wanted to follow and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So there was a awareness of evidence, a consciousness of preserving evidence, a thoughtfulness to it all.
Well, you've got to not only get the guy, but the case has to stand up in court.
Yeah.
Axel is a cop. He may bend the rules, but he isn't... I was going to say, he isn't a lawbreaker. I mean, he's breaking and, well, he's entering. I don't know that he's so much breaking. Lockpicking, certainly. So, again, he's got the moral compass, but he certainly bends over the line.
Yeah.
You know, stretches over the line a bit.
Well, one of the scenes I really enjoyed was when he follows people into a party that he hasn't been invited into. And it's kind of a, well, if I'm going to get thrown out of the party, I'm going to get them thrown out of the party with me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I liked how he went about getting them thrown out, because there are no punches thrown. There are none of those cliche things you can do. It's more of a, I can use my words for this situation.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you've got to have the protagonist and antagonist kind of facing off at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the sort of thing that in some films, it took the writers a while to figure out how do we do that. Die Hard's a good example of that. Whole thing is taking place over the radios, but you've got to have John McClane and Hans face to face at some point to really have that situation. So I think they worked it in here. It felt organic. It made sense. And there were a couple of things they certainly did just for the laughs or whatnot, like the whole bit when they're doing a car chase in a cement truck.
That I loved when it turned out Axel was trying to figure out how tall someone was. Because at first, it looked like it was purely for the laughs. Well, if they're that much taller than me, I'm going to go up on my toes to get eye to eye with them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and we've had a couple of times where in the car chases, you've got to wreck the squad cars. You've got to knock over the things on the side, be it parking meters or things of that sort. Some of that is almost, I don't want to say cliche how do you set up a car chase in a movie?
Mm.
But it is.
Mm-hmm. How many fire plugs are you going to bowl over?
Fire plugs do you run over? Cars you smash into and spin around? Do you get the fruit stand at some point or the fruit truck at one point? You know, things of that sort. And there's only a finite number of things that can happen in a car chase. It's not, do you do anything original, but do you stack them together in an interesting sequence?
Yes.
And overall, I think they did. I thought all their action sequences were fun to watch, lasted the appropriate amount of time, and treated the characters with respect. In the showdown at the end, Axel knows there's kind of the two head people left. He sees one of them, and he knows the other one's going to be gunning for him quite literally.
Yeah.
So he's keeping an eye, and when he sees a shadow of something, it's like, okay, this is my shot.
Yes.
So I thought that was well done. And they are able to slow things down enough without losing the momentum of the action sequence either.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought they did a great job with that.
I think Judge Reinhold, as Billy, he deserves buku credit for, during that big blowout of a fight scene at the end, his bit with the rocket launcher.
Mm.
That was great comedy.
Well, I loved when he picked up the rocket launcher. Yes. And Taggart's like, well, you don't have one of these, do you? Because he's got a damn near arsenal. He's like, well, no, I don't. I'll take.
Yes.
And he just kind of Taggart shakes his head. That's not what I was going for.
I lost track of how many times Taggart gave him the fatherly, we really have to talk about this.
Those two play well off each other.
Yeah.
And having that kind of buddy cop kind of situation works.
Mm-hmm.
Because you could see where their relationship was at when they're talking in the car about Taggart's wife having left him and all that stuff. How far can Billy go without getting kind of the pushback or whatever? And at what point does Taggart say, you know, enough?
Yeah, yeah.
So I thought that was well done. And it humanizes them.
Yes.
We had Dean Stockwell as one of the bad guy characters.
Mm-hmm.
Terrific actor, did a terrific job. It wasn't a huge role.
Mm-mm.
But I think Dean Stockwell always did great with whatever he was given.
Yeah.
He was great here. He was in the revival of Battlestar Galactica.
Mm.
Did a terrific job there. Obviously, Quantum Leap.
Yeah.
You know, to name just a few things he's done. And then we had a few other people sprinkled in that were not necessarily big names then, although they were known. Gilbert Gottfried was in a scene, Hugh Hefner and stuff. But then one of the other ones was Chris Rock as a parking valet.
Yeah.
He's there for 30 seconds to a minute or whatever, but does good with the role. And then Robert Pastorelli from Murphy Brown was in the beginning sequence in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
But that was fun. It's always cool to see some familiar faces and stuff.
Well, and Paul Guilfoyle played Thermopolis. He did like 300 episodes of CSI.
Mm, okay.
So he definitely went to TV from this.
Not having watched CSI, there are a couple of those things that are kind of lost on me. It's always interesting of what do people recognize the actors from and stuff, and it comes down to, well, what have you watched?
Yes, yeah.
Because somebody could be on literally 1,000 episodes of a show, but if you never watched the show...
Well, it intrigues me at times, because you'll look at somebody in IMDb, and at first you'll see somebody who only has 10 credits, but then when you look at the 10 credits, it might be like... Bold and the Beautiful, 5,000 episodes. And that's very different than someone who has 15 credits and they're all two-hour movies.
Well, I've seen a few, and this is where I think IMDb, I wish they would display things a little differently. Because if you've got a dozen credits and they are shorts or other things that people have never seen, you don't have much of a background. If you've got 12 credits and they're two-hour TV movies and stuff, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe you're a young kid in background type roles. But then there are others that they've got two credits, but they were on those shows for like 20 years or something crazy, and like every episode or something. I mean, the number of credits they have versus the depth and breadth of the credit.
Yeah.
How many episodes, how pivotal of a role.
Yeah.
And there are some of these that, and Chris Rock, this was not a pivotal role for him. Bronson Pinchot in the first film, also not a pivotal one, but I think he made more of the role.
No, but for Chris Rock, and purely guessing here, but it strikes me as helping get his SAG card.
That could be. It would not surprise me if Eddie Murphy was I don't want to say handing out roles, but trying to get people he wanted to work with, liked their stand-up, or needed to get their foot in the door in the acting side of things, maybe.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if any of that's true or not, but it wouldn't surprise me.
I mean, that's one of the things that it can be very easy to forget is that you have to do a certain number of hours on actual SAG productions to get a SAG card. And there are some productions that simply will not hire you unless you've already got your SAG card. So it's a bit of a catch-22.
You've got to start somewhere is what it comes down to. And yeah. Sometimes getting that first role is the hardest thing.
This is Chris Rock's second credit.
I was wondering, what was his first?
Crush Groove, and his character was named Person Standing Next to Club Phone During Fight, uncredited.
That's the kind of credit I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. It's like, yep, technically you were in the film.
Yeah.
That's why I always get annoyed with articles that say so-and-so star of. It's like, okay, that show went on X years. They were in one episode and weren't even a focal character then.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, on a technicality, what was said was basically true.
Yeah.
But misleading nonetheless. I appreciated that we got the same captain or whatever back in Detroit.
Yes.
They've kept the cast going as much as, not even as much as possible. It didn't feel like there were any notable absences. I think Bronson Pinchot's character comes back in a later one, but he wasn't needed here and wasn't missed.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they're doing a good job. Obviously, the music was terrific this time around as well. Different selection of songs, but they had the same energy to them.
Yes.
And I don't say they sounded the same, but I guess the way to put it is they felt the same.
Yes. They had that same feeling of the period, as well as that same upbeat tempo and vibe.
Yeah, the upbeat tempo and vibe. And I think here, it's only 3 years later, so the music wouldn't have changed radically at that point. And they know the property, and having that kind of high energy dance music kind of a feel to it is what definitely what they're going for. And then, of course, keeping the Axl F stuff throughout.
Yeah.
You can't do this kind of a film without it.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, and by having Billy and Taggart on the outs with the captain or lieutenant at their own precinct, they were out in the field more with Axl, more of an active part of his investigation. And that was kind of fun.
Yeah, it was more an ensemble than a solo last time.
Mm-hmm.
And there was really, it's funny because I was going to say there was no antagonistic cops trailing them, keeping an eye on them, that kind of a thing. But they held true to that aspect of the first film with the, all this happened as you guys are nearby. Shouldn't you have been on traffic duty or whatever?
Yes, yes.
It's like, well, we're off duty and technically this is traffic duty, you know, and
yes,
having that guy in charge of their precinct now who is eradicating everybody of the former group and doing it without it being he's corrupt and he's pushing all the good cops out.
Yeah.
And him getting his comeuppance at the end.
Yeah.
So those sorts of things they put in and they pay off.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate that aspect. Because it's not uncommon for things to have to happen at the beginning to we got to establish the lead, but none of that really matters in any way, shape, or form.
Mm-hmm.
Even little things like Paul Rudd's character driving the Ferrari has a little bit of payoff at the end. Is it big? No. Is it fun? Sure.
Uh-huh. Exactly. And does it serve to get Axl into just a little bit of trouble?
Yes. Yes. Well, and both films end on Axl driving off away from Taggart and Billy, basically looking back saying, trust me.
Yeah.
And them saying, no, this isn't going to go well kind of a deal.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm curious if that holds true in the other films.
Yeah, me too.
Because do they have to do that? No. But there's an aspect of the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of fun.
Well, Axl has a fun attitude that I think is really summed up for me at the going into the gun club carrying Billy's bag of vitamins and that whole sequence of kind of the, not just can he think on his toes and ad lib a situation, but it's on the one hand so over the top, but on the other hand, just over the top enough that people fall into his trap.
Well, it's funny because his improvisational aspect there is similar to what we saw in Psych.
Mm, yes.
But in Psych, it was very over the top.
Yes.
And it's like, how stupid do they got to be to believe this or whatever? It's not like he's trying to fool them or whatever. Whereas here, he's definitely running a mini con or whatever off the top of his head. And there were one or two times where you could tell he was literally making it up as he went.
Yeah.
When he was in the police station at Beverly Hills at the beginning. And that was kind of fun. But having a character that can pull that off and do, I don't say the Sherlock Holmes detective thing, but kind of, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like he's all con artist. He's got the goods to back it up. He's able to get out of a firefight. And sometimes people get the drop on him. He's not infallible either.
He knows when to be serious.
Yes.
He embraces the joy of life, but he does know when to be serious. Well, and the going to, what was the name of the club? 385 North?
Yeah.
That whole how they got in their sequence and everything. The type of club was a callback to the first movie.
It was a very different take on that equivalent scene from the first film,
mm-hmm.
but reminiscent of.
Yeah.
Even with them coming out of it with a certain amount of notoriety, but for very different reasons.
Yeah, yes.
And that's, again, do you go down the same sort of path? Do you reverse it? Do you put a twist on it? And I think this film was very much a sequel to the first.
Well, and to your point of being very reminiscent of the similar scene to the first movie, we still had Taggart wanting to be very honest.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I like how they're able to do those callbacks, have similar scenes, but we've had other franchises where in one of the later ones, we get to a scene and it's like, oh, well, this is going to be this movie's take on that scene.
Yes, yes.
And in a way that, can it be good enough to get past our, I almost want to say, blatant expectations, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Our unimpressedness with the unoriginality with it. Whereas I never felt that with this film.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And there were a couple of things I considered minor callbacks to the first, like when one of the armored trucks of bad guys is driving off, the back door's open, the guy's swinging on the back yep. door, much like Axel at the beginning of the first film.
I was thinking that too.
Is it really a callback? Is it not? Is it just a standard car chase thing? Don't know, don't care. I'll credit them for the callback.
Yeah.
And having those kinds of things where we remember enjoying the first film and we're not feeling like we're watching just a thin repaint over it. Because again, we've all seen those sequels where version 2 is replace bad guy name, his crime's slightly different, change maybe the color of the car.
Mm-hmm.
Update the songs a little bit, and not much else changes.
25 years, maybe a little more than that ago, Turner Classic Movies was once a week doing a night that they called the double feature.
Mm, you've told me about some of these in the past.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Well, they'll show a more vintage film, followed by the remake.
Yeah, yeah. There was one night that was really fascinating because their double feature was actually a triple feature.
Mm.
Okay. Two of the movies, they used the same scripts.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah.
And the same sets. They even had some of the same costumes. The difference was color film had been invented.
Oh, that's interesting. Color adds a different dimension to it.
Yeah.
As well as the different actors, director, and director.
Same director.
Same director, even. How about that, director of photography?
I think that was different. But the same director had wanted to do it again, but do it in color. And that's why he had gotten same script and that stuff. And then the last of the three movies, the bad guy was played by the guy who had played the young handsome prince in the first one.
I've seen a few where they're doing a revitalization of the property, or it's a remake of the film or revival of it, whatever. And they bring some of the people from the original in to kind of acknowledge that they were part of the property before this version of it.
Mm-hmm.
Other times to win over the audience or what have you.
Yeah.
Everything from John Wesley Shipp, who was the Flash on the CBS one season show way back when, to being the CW version.
Yeah.
And if you look at the Christopher Reeve Superman, there were a couple of people there from the George Reeves TV show.
Mm.
The one who played Jimmy and one of the ones, because they had two Loises. So that kind of a thing, I like that. And it's always fun to see how And some of it is an actor will age out of the role they had been in, but there's an older role that they're now suitable for or
exactly.
whatever.
And that was what had happened here.
I'm waiting for that to happen such that somebody is able to edit together the two productions.
Oh.
And see the actor, the younger version, playing off the older version.
Yeah.
And that'd be tough to do, but we're getting with both AI and advanced editing tools, even without the AI type stuff, that you could do some very interesting things there.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to think who I would like to see in that kind of dual roles and stuff. But I also think there's some characters that I don't want to say are timeless characters, but like with Axel Foley here, 3 years passed, no visible difference.
Yeah.
But looking at Eddie Murphy from the first film and Eddie Murphy of today.
Yeah.
Okay, he's definitely older. Doesn't look visibly that much older or out of shape or anything remotely like that. It's like, okay, he aged. It's been 40 years. You expect that. It doesn't feel, he hadn't aged 40 years is what I'm trying to get to and stuff. So I think there's going to come a point where the AI technology is able to do this and we figured out the legalities, the moralities, and the logistics where you could have a 90-year-old Eddie Murphy okaying the adventures of a young Axel Foley.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With, nope, I'd have done it this way or do it this way, or, you know, still having his input, but not having to physically do all the work or what have you.
Yeah.
And I think there's some pros and cons to that. But I think this is a character, again, they've built a world in the first film. They've continued it here in the second film without missing a beat, implying some backstory between the two films, and really growing not just the Beverly Hills Cop group, but the Detroit one.
Yeah.
And they were really under no obligation to do all of that.
Yeah, now, I agree. I appreciated it, though.
They're at the point where in the next film, if we start in Detroit again, Axel's got to go help or save somebody in Beverly Hills again. They got to get a little more creative on that.
Yeah.
But there's an aspect of if it still works and it's not broken, don't fix it either.
There is that.
So I'm enjoying this. I know the next film is another 6-7 years down the line to where it takes place about 10 years after the first. And I'm pretty sure I've seen that one, but again, I haven't seen these since around the time they were released.
Yeah, I don't remember if I watched all three of them way back when.
I'm not even positive if I'd seen this one before or not.
Yeah, I just can't remember.
And the thing of it is, they are fun roller coaster rides, and it's not one of those that once you've seen them, oh, that's it. I've got the twist. I'm good.
Yeah.
I never have to see this again. These are kind of that feel-good action-adventure film. It's popcorn fare, and I mean that in the best of ways.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
There are some films I want good plot. There's some I want good mystery. Some I want great action sequences. Some I just want to be a fun, enjoyable way to spend the time.
Yeah.
Ideally, you get all of that. But for some things, once you've cracked the mystery, once you've seen the twist on the action or whatever, how many times can you go back to that well?
Yeah.
For an action stuff, unless it's like a Jackie Chan or similar ilk choreography where it's just amazing to watch, okay, I've seen the fight scene. I don't need to see that one again. And a lot of action films fall into that for me. I'm continuing to enjoy this. Looking forward to the next one.
Yeah, me too.
Anything else?
I think that does it.
Cool.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you like this episode, please spread the word about the Comic Book Page podcast by telling your friends and posting a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And please, join our Slack community and let us know what you thought of this episode. I do this podcast because I enjoy talking about comics. So let's talk about comics. The show notes, forum, and instructions for how to join our Slack channel can be found at www.comicbookpage.com. The opinions of the co-hosts and guests are their own. The Comic Book Page podcast is copyright John Mayall. And thanks again for listening.